podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
You want to talk about bug bitten. I'm referring, of course, when I say you want to talk about, I'm referring to our brand. You know, we haven't addressed the brand's spickety new intro. Anyone curious about that music in the brand's spickety new intro? That's by a band. You're going to see some good hosting right now because I'm going to make this work a minute. That piece of music within that intro, when the tree's falling down, you hear tree falling, and there's a intro song. That's a band called Shearwater. That song is from an album, Jet Plane and Oxbow. I'm friends with that musician. He's very undecided about hunting. I've taken him fishing, and he enjoyed being out there, but he said, I just don't view fish and things the way you do. But he's a wonderful musician. And the reason here's where the good hosting comes in, because for a long time that musician was based out of Austin, and we're in Texas right now. See how seamless that was? We're in Maverick County, which is it fair to say that this is ground zero? This is like the base. This is the heart and soul of like the whole Texas whitetail big buck world. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Yeah. For giant whitetails.
That was the voice of El Ocho, Ben Binion. Binion?
Binion.
So it's the same sound as your first name.
Yeah. It sounds like you stutter a little bit.
Ben Binion.
Yeah.
That was the voice of Ben Binion. We're going to get to him in a minute. Also, here's Chris Gill. Chris already warned us he doesn't have much to say. He's just sitting in and listening. And Giannis Brutelis. At this point in the show, I'd normally plug Giannis's t-shirt company, but I'm not anymore because he won't make me my perch flies.
Oh.
I had asked Giannis.
He's going to get him one way or another.
I asked Giannis probably about
18 months, I'm guessing.
18 months ago.
I think it was SHOT Show 2015.
To make me a couple perch flies. I'm talking about flies used for yellow perch. You take a little bit of, you take a hook, take a little bit of bucktail, you take a little bit of thread. I'd make them myself, but I gave my damn, what's the bobbin? Bobbin?
Yeah.
I gave my bobbin to a buddy of mine, because I used to tie a couple flies now, and then I just got enough things I like to do, and that got low on the list of things I like to do, and I just gave it all away. And then asked Yanni to make me some, and he won't make them for me. Can you explain to people why you won't make them over 18 months?
There's no real reason other than that all my shit's, my fly tying shit's packed away.
It must be pretty packed away.
Like when you ask me to reload some ammo, usually get to that pretty quickly because that bench is operational right now.
But the tie-in bench is not operational.
No, man, it's under a half an inch of dust, and that dust is heavy.
Really? Also, Yanni's in the process of buying himself a new home.
Yeah, maybe I'll set up a bench when I get there.
So, Ben, I can't even begin. There's so many things I want to ask you about or have you talk about that you've already told me about that I can't even think of where to start. Give me the Ben Binion bio.
I started.
Let me interrupt.
Okay.
I'm not doing a good job. Ben is, what do you call what you do? A land manager?
I consider myself a wildlife biologist.
All right. Ben's a wildlife biologist. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. Ben's a wildlife biologist working in the private sector, and you run the wildlife program on a large ranch, large property in South Texas.
Correct.
Okay, now I'll get into the whole where you came from, what kind of education you sought out, and what your dictate is, your you know, your mandate, not dictate. That reminds me of an old joke. What your mandate is.
Yeah. Well, I started out kind of whenever I was when I was younger, my when my parents split up and my my stepdad, my mom remarried, and my stepdad ran a took care of a piece of property not too far from here.
In Maverick County.
No, it was but it was right on the border of Maverick County.
So
right
some of the big bucks strayed over into that county.
Pretty much, yeah. It was one of the it was top five counties for big bucks. And he took care of that place for I guess pretty much from about 10 years old on, and I saw what was going on there, and I wanted to do it, and I was trying to figure out how to go about it, and so basically what I did is after high school, I went to college to pursue a degree in range and wildlife science at Texas A&M Kingsville, which at the time was the number one college in the nation for wildlife program, and
is
I believe
the Aggies.
No, it's
that's not Aggies.
It's part of that system.
Yeah,
but like Texas A&M College Station, which you see the Aggies on TV.
Yep.
This is a what do you call it? A like a branch of that
satellite school. Campus.
Satellite campus. Yeah, we had our own football team and our own mascot, and we were much higher on the as far as ranked in a wildlife program than the main campus because gotcha. Of the is mainly because of the experience level that you could get while in class
firsthand,
and every day we were every class every junior senior level class, you know, plant ID and those kind of classes were in the field, and our exams were in the field. Our exams were verbal. I mean, walking through brush, cactus, everything that we've been walking through this week. But so I went there, and while I was working on the ranch that my stepdad took care of, and I was kind of, I guess you could say, just a more of a ranch hand than anything, just did odds and ends, fixing fences and everything. But I developed a passion for deer. I always loved to hunt, and but I really, really wanted to figure out, you know, what made deer big and why were they big in this area we're Southwest Texas, I guess you can say. And so I started kind of paying attention to everything while I was in college and getting the degree.
And were they teaching you about whitetail deer in college?
Yeah, or yes and no. It was more they were giving us the tools to learn. And they didn't focus on any one species. They didn't focus on quail or whitetails. They did a little, you know, they touched on it. But everything that they taught us, you can apply to any species.
Yep, I'm with you.
And then so what I did is I took everything I learned and applied it to whitetails while we were going through the courses through college. And whenever I graduated, I graduated in 2008. I graduated high school in 2004, college 2008 in spring. And the owner of the property offered me a job, and which was kind of
the place you grew up on.
The place I grew up on, which is kind of the end all plan, was my stepdad was going to retire and I was going to take over his position. Well, I graduated in May. And in April of 2008, my stepdad had an accident, and he fell out of a deer stand. He fell 14 feet to the ground on a rocky hill, so it was a hard hill. And he broke both of his wrists, compound fractures, broke almost all of his ribs, lacerated a kidney, lungs filled up with fluid, created an induced trauma heart attack. They airlifted him to San Antonio. He was in ICU for 30 days. This happened on April 14th. I graduated May 10th. So I didn't walk the stage on graduation because I didn't have any family that would be there to watch me because they were all at the hospital with him in the ICU. So what I was doing while I was that last month in college is I was coming back to the ranch because I knew we had seven employees. So I kept the ranch running while he was in the hospital.
And just to back up here, the ranch. This is a cattle operation.
Cattle. It was a. It's a cattle operation with a side note of hunting.
Yeah.
In the
so a heavy emphasis on wildlife.
Right. A heavy emphasis on wildlife. The family in the family was the main people that hunted it. It was not a commercial operation. It wasn't fenced. It was just a fun place for the family and friends and guests and some business associates of the owner. And so basically what I was kind of thrown headfirst when my stepdad was in the hospital, I graduated and took the job and took over his position. So I was started from the ground level whenever I was in college. As soon as I graduated, I went straight to the top.
Yeah.
Because I was forced into it more than anything. And I changed a few things on the wildlife side, and we were that ranch that or that property was under pretty intense management for, I don't know, 15 years, maybe 18 years before I took over. And we had really nice whitetails, and the whitetails were, you know, there was big antlered deer everywhere. And but I never really intended to make them bigger. I was just trying to kind of fill in. And that was about the time that trail cameras started getting real popular as far as infrared and, you know, started getting, I guess, user-friendly and cheap enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started running trail cameras, and we started noticing what deer would do from year to year as far as antler development, you know, movement, rutting habits, you know, forage habits, bedding areas, everything you could figure out with the trail cams. And so I started.
Do you feel that really rewrote people's understandings?
I think the trail camera is probably the best thing that's happened to hunting and to managing wildlife, in my opinion, in my lifetime.
You know, a biologist in New York just put out a book about the significance of what they call a camera trap to the field. He published sort of what he thinks of as, I think, the 300 or 600 like very influential trail cam images or camera trap images, and talked about the implications that tool had for understanding distribution and range of wildlife, travel patterns of wildlife. I want you to continue that, but I was at this thing a few years ago in North Carolina, and it was a deer, like a wildlife expo. A guy there was telling me this story about someone. Have we talked about this on the podcast? The Kentucky, Tennessee bucks. Did I ever tell you about this?
You've told me about it. I don't know if we've mentioned it on the podcast.
All right. So Kentucky and Tennessee have different season structures, hunting season structures, and they obviously share pretty long border. So a guy comes forth with some big buck that he claims they have shot in one or the other. Let's just for discussion's sake, let's say he comes forth with this big buck, says, "Well, I shot it in Kentucky." Okay.
It was probably vice versa, because I think Tennessee has the liberal allotments.
So comes forward and says, "I shot this big giant buck in Tennessee." Winds up being like some state record for the year buck. He gets a bunch of publicity. The buck tours around at a couple of these shows. I'm talking about these wildlife expos. Eventually, a guy from Kentucky sees the big famous Tennessee buck and says, "I know that buck. I'll show you a trail cam picture of that buck hundreds of miles away from where this man claims that he shot it." And the buck had such a distinctive rack. They successfully prosecuted the man and seized the head.
Yeah.
Because of this guy's trail cam pictures of where that buck was on what day it was there. And he had just shot it out of season, and to make it legal, came back across the border.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
There's a trail cam story for you.
Yeah. Yeah. They use the wardens. The wardens.
You that one, Chris. You like that one, don't you? That one. Chris is still nodding.
Yeah. The wardens here use them, similar deal where they,
right?
Like if a deer of interest comes about and shot by a hunter and it's poached, you know, the landowner can knows it's missing and it shows up somewhere, sees a picture of it somewhere, and he says, that, you know, that deer came off of my property, and he's surrounded by several other private properties.
Yeah, like, so he didn't travel 100 miles that day or whatever.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And they prosecuted several people now on this exact same situation. It's probably, it wasn't, you know, nothing that high profile. But yeah, same deal.
Yeah.
But
so, yeah, so this guy's got a book coming out about just how much that changed our understanding of, you know, all different kinds of wildlife.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw some trail cam images that came out of Afghanistan one time where it was some really rare sheep. You can see it going through a pass.
Mm-hmm.
And the next images are a couple dudes with the Afghanistan that we're all so familiar with now, the hats that, you know, from the Afghan war, you see people wearing, and long robes and a couple Kalashnikovs going through the pass right behind it, going chasing after it.
Yeah.
So anyhow, there you are. All of a sudden you're managing that place. And you start using trail cams.
Yeah, we started using trail cams, and I started noticing changes in antler development that from year to year that were bizarre to me, because these jumps or these increases in antler size on deer that we thought we would recognize from year to year, from season to season, because their home ranges. And tell me if I'm getting off point at
any
point, but. The home ranges are, you know, on our mature bucks are about 4,000 to 8,000 acres. And so you always, on a piece of property, you have
your... What do you guys figure? Put that into a square mile.
It'd be like 10 to 12, I think. 10 to 12 square miles.
Okay.
That 640 is a square mile. So you know, a buck's home range is 10 to 12 square miles. And, of course, you have tons of overlap. And... Our density was about a deer per 25 acres, a deer. So, and we had a 1-to-1 buck doe ratio, so we had a buck per 50 acres.
Okay.
So square miles, that would be, 10 bucks per square mile?
So but, a total of maybe 20 deer per square mile.
Yeah, 15 bucks per square mile maybe. You know, all different age classes. But anyway, what I started noticing is these bucks that we thought we knew, let me back up. We were harvesting, the family was harvesting trophy bucks every year that were exceptional. But sometimes we did not know what that deer had been. He just showed up. And we'd harvest them, and we'd look at their teeth based off of all the studies that have been done on age by tooth wear and replacement, which, you know, some people say it's the only thing we have to go off of. Is by the teeth. It's not very accurate, but it's the only thing we have.
Yeah.
But the teeth would be sharp, so they indicating that they were a young buck. So what I started doing is I started documenting these deer with the trail cameras, and find out why, you know, we're shooting these deer that looked old, but they had sharp teeth, and we'd never seen them before.
Because let me just fill in a little bit. What you're suggesting is you guys felt that you could look at a deer's antlers and then immediately recognize him again the next year because he'd just be a little bit bigger version.
Right.
But then all of a sudden, here's this deer who, like, where'd he come from? Because I didn't see a slightly smaller version of him last year.
That's exactly correct.
Okay.
That's exactly correct. So I started documenting deer based off of their locations and their home ranges, and would save pictures from year to year to see which ones look similar. And I started noticing that there was bucks making huge, huge jumps. And, I mean, they would go from 120-inch deer to 160 or 170-inch deer in one growing season. And usually that was, what we were guessing to be a 3- or 4-year-old deer to a 4- or 5-year-old deer. That age group was usually the big jumps. So we started doing is documenting those deer as far as based off of trail cams. And I started doing that, and we started letting deer go. No matter how big they were, they'd be 170-inch deer that we would typically shoot. We said, "Well, we'll let him go and see what happens."
And because of his age.
Because of his age, we wanted to see. We were trying to figure out when was the peak. You know, that's what everybody in the whitetail industry tries to figure out is what's the peak age? When do they peak out? And we think in Texas down here, we think it's a little older than everywhere else, but we're different. And whitetails are really site specific animals. I mean, it changes 20 miles, changes completely as far as deer to deer. So anyway,
what is the age?
What we found, or what my personal research and what other research institutes are finding, it depends on the ranch. It depends on the property. It depends on the location. It depends on the deer. They're all individual. But in my opinion, our deer in Maverick County and that county were maximizing their antler potential at 7 and 8 years old, not 5 and 6 like previously thought. All of that was just an estimation before at 5 and 6. And some of those deer, people were estimating them, and they're actually younger. So with the trail cams, we can get a better idea of their age based off of if we have 3 years of pictures and he wasn't 2 years old in the first picture, he's at least 5 or 6. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what we went off of. And we started letting these deer grow to be 7 and 8 years old and 9 years old before we harvest them. And we can see these deer. We're feeding, and they're coming out every day, and they're not every day, but I'm seeing them in the trail cams every day. And they're still hard to hunt. They're nocturnal, even though we're feeding. And we started letting these deer grow to a lot older age class than anybody else was, and we started noticing that, hey, we just stepped up our game. You know, we went from killing a couple of 160 class deer and a 170 here and there to killing 180s every year with an occasional 200 in a 3 or 4 year period. And then in year 6, we were killing multiple 190s with a 200 almost every year. And this was solely due from knowing the individual deer through trail camera.
Yeah.
And you can't always tell antlers year to year, but what we were doing is we knew where the deer was, his home range. He did the same thing each year. You know, in October, he'd be here. In November, he'd be here. Then the next year, a deer that looked similar to him but bigger would do the same thing. So we assumed it was the same deer. We weren't always right. It was me more than anything. I wasn't always right on that, but most part we were. And we stepped up our game big time as far as growing big deer. And so I guess about year 7, these current landowners that were on this property we were at now in Maverick County approached me through a mutual friend and asked, I guess I met them at year 6. And they approached me to try to find they just purchased this property, and they approached me to find a ranch foreman and wildlife biologist to run this property for them, and they wanted nothing else other than to grow giant whitetails. That's all they wanted to do, or let them grow.
No cattle.
And they asked me, they said, would you be willing to leave your current position? I said, no, I grew up here, and I'm happy, and I don't want to do it. Well, that went on. And I looked for a couple people for them, but I could never find anybody that I thought I could recommend and put my name on. But a year later, they made me an offer to come over here that I couldn't turn down. So I came and started applying the same basic knowledge that I was doing there with the trail cameras and the inventory of the deer here. And it's a 5 to 6 year deal before you can really start seeing consistent results on growing these big whitetails.
But your job, like, you're a salaried individual.
Yep.
And your job is to take a sizable chunk of land here.
Yep.
And the end goal that you're pursuing is to increase the number and size of big giant whitetail bucks.
Exactly. Yep. Before, on the old property, I had I was doing that almost as a side note because we had cattle and a little bit of agriculture crop, and the hunting was a side note.
Yeah.
And now, You know, and that's the part that I enjoyed the most. That's the part that I developed a passion for.
Now you're just strictly wildlife.
Just strictly wildlife. And we don't do, I mean, that's 100% of what we're after is improving the wildlife.
All right, let me ask some real basic stuff. What are, and Yanni, jump in whenever you need to. This place is not a fence place.
Correct.
Are there fence places here? Like, why are some places in Texas? We always hear about, like, the fence properties. What do you gain and lose? Like, why did you not? You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
Why did you not come in and be like, first thing we're going to do, boys, is build a big damn fence?
Yeah, because that's the fences in Texas are man, it's a touchy subject. They can be.
Yeah, but just talk. You don't even need to weigh in. Just tell me like the thinking, right? Okay.
Well, the main thinking in the reason fences were originally, you know, set up for deer in Texas.
And what year, you told us earlier, in what year did you say they became popular?
I think the first official one was in the late 60s, was when the first one that was made with railroad ties and some sheep and goat net fence.
And what kind of acreage?
That one was 8,000 acres.
Oh, and so big. We're not talking about like 400 acre.
No, they started out as large properties, and what they started out as is to keep their neighbors from killing their deer. Or for harvesting their deer prematurely.
Because they're like, we're running a management program, practicing some restraint, and then inevitably the big bucks that we're producing by providing good habitat and all that are getting shot by some hoser on the next property.
Right. That's done what he's done his whole life, and there's nothing wrong with it. He's just hunting. But he's not as intense. That's the way the fences started out, and that was a great, great tool. But
That was the motivation.
Yeah. So what happened was is, in my opinion, people just got greedy, and they started, you know, fencing smaller properties and figuring out that they could have a quick fix. It's just like, you know, that's just people. They want to get it fast.
What do you mean a quick fix?
As far as growing trophy whitetails, they started realizing that you could take a, you know, that's the pen industry or the raising, farming, wildlife really started up in the, I guess, about the 90s, which is, it took from the first high fence in the 60s, there was almost nobody doing it for that, you know, almost 30 years.
And was that first place a private facility, or was it like a hunt, like an outfitting establishment?
It was a private research. It was a private property, and the university did it as a research project to start. And found out that it worked, and that's when they started publishing their research, and that's kind of just escalated from there. And so basically, people just started fencing in smaller and smaller properties, and all of a sudden, the pen developed, kind of almost accidentally, just fencing off small pieces of property and seeing what they could concentrate growing these, you know, Frankenstein type deer, and that's what it's evolved in, and that's what people see on TV on the pen stuff with all these freakishly big deer that can barely hold up their head.
Mm-hmm.
But in my opinion, that's kind of where it started and where we are now, and it puts a bad taste in people's mouth for the fences.
So it's not having a fence. Like, you've worked at two places that are not fenced. Are they not fenced for aesthetic reasons, or are they not fenced for long term?
They're not fenced. Well, the other one is I guess you could say it's not completely fenced. It is partially fenced on one side, but that's that one was we got along with our neighbors, and they practiced the same management plans that management practices that we did. This place. Is the owners of this property are super anti pen deer, super anti high fence. They like Boone and Crockett Club, and they really want to be able to enter deer that we harvest here in the Boone and Crockett system,
which means natural reproduction.
Which natural reproduction, no human contact, no direct human contact, and that's. Pretty much, that's the whole reason. In Maverick County, I forgot what what magazine did the deal, but they rated the top 50 counties in the nation for whitetail entry since 2004. I can't remember if it was one of the, you know, more common long-term magazines, but they rated the top 50 counties in the nation for Boone and Crockett whitetail entries since 2004. Maverick County was number one, typical, and number two, non-typical entries. And I believe that was, it was the only Texas county in the top 10. It might have been the only Texas county in the top 50. But that's why they chose to buy a piece of property in Maverick County. And they came to me and they said, can we grow big deer without a fence? And I said, absolutely. All you have to do is let them grow. But you have to get a property big enough where your neighbors aren't going to be shooting every single one. So if you're on a smaller property, during the rut, the deer are going to go across the fence. And anybody in their right mind, deer that looks old, mature, and has a big rag, they're going to blast it.
They're not going to care if it's like that, you know, if you let it go two more years, they're not probably not going to see it anyway.
Right, right. They're not. They don't. Yeah. They're there for that weekend or that day to hunt, and they see a big deer and they're going to shoot it. It's a completely different dynamic than most people consider hunting. We're not farming them, but we're watching them grow, I guess. It's similar to some guys that have good mule deer in elk country out west that name their bulls so that way they can keep up with locating them the following year.
Yeah.
On public ground, even. It's real similar to that. We're just doing it in the private sector.
So how many bucks are you keeping an eye on?
I think I have on my inventory list right now, I might have 300 or 400, I guess.
That you have photo documentation of? How much time do you spend, besides the trail cameras, how much time do you spend out what observing and photographing deer just to get to know who's all out there?
October 1st through February 15th, I'm in the field at least 6 days a week, most of the time 7 days a week, for, you know, morning and evening, two or three hours in the morning, 2-3 hours in the evening, almost every day.
In a stand observing deer.
In a stand observing deer with the camera. I use a big lens out of the stand to supplement the trail cameras. And I'm running about 35 to 40 trail cameras from August 15th to February or March, and 40,000 pictures roughly a week. And that's my Monday, Tuesday. So,
and that's just to try to get to know who's here.
Yep. I'm just getting to know them. That's all I'm doing.
And within that, how often does a deer pop up?
It depends on his personality.
How often does a deer pop up that you had no idea was here, even though you're doing all that time looking? Like, how much mystery is left?
Around the perimeters, when we get influx from the neighbors during December, during the rut, there is, I'll run into a new deer probably, you know, whenever I say new deer, everything that I'm noticing is usually 3 years old and older, because it's hard to distinguish the ones, twos, and 3 year olds year to year. But yeah. once they hit three and four, they're easier to distinguish year to year.
And you're not distinguishing them off the antlers.
Well,
it's helpful, but correct. There's other things. Tell me, like, cause you explained to me some of the things you're actually looking for.
Yeah.
Which allow you to tell it one deer from the other.
Yeah. So
what explain the posture of the photographs too, because that's interesting.
Yeah. So my field photos with my camera from the stand, I try to get the bucks broadside, looking in my direction, with their ears perked and their hocks offset. And I do that because you can tell age based off the hocks. You can't tell an exact age, but it helps you narrow down the age. And then the broadside, of course, lets you look at all the different traits, such as the chest, the brisket, you know, the swaying belly or flat back, But what I
which
do
is age, right?
Which is all for age purposes only. But usually, if I've been watching them, I'm not worried about aging them on those pictures. I'm worried about an identifier, what I call an identifier. And what I consider an identifier is something like a split ear, like a, you know, I'm talking like a quarter inch nick on the tip of the right ear, or, you know, on the bottom side of the ear, there's, you know, a quarter of the way up, there's a black spot, and they'll carry these characteristics year to year, and or a dark forehead, or a double throat patch, double white throat patch, or a bobtail. Or any kind of distinguishing scar, or you know, there's a ton of them when you start really studying and looking. There's a ton of different characteristics that you can look at that are not associated with antlers, because yeah. Antlers change so much. You never know. You can usually recognize them year to year once they get older, but the ear splits and the tails and stuff like that little stuff that you can pick up on. And I can't remember it all. That's why we're documenting it with we document it with the infield photos from the stand, and that's why I try to get them in that posture, that position, to that way I may not know that deer this year because I didn't notice something, but I take a picture of a deer in that same area next year that looks kind of similar, and I put the two together. Then the third year, I take another picture of that same deer and that same deal. So then I create a catalog of inventory of deer from year to year, and it helps me understand their age better. And I can let them, we can therefore decide if we want to harvest them or not.
You're making that decision.
I'm making that decision. Yeah. And, some people think that's, you know, that's a little bit, too far into it, I guess, or thinking too much about it. And it's taken some of the hunting part away, but my bosses don't know that I know that deer, or they know I know that deer, but they don't know that deer. They've never seen him before, so it's still hunting to the right people. But there's several of these bucks that I'm getting pictures of. I'll have 30 to 35 hunts looking for them and never see them.
Meaning. You'll identify a buck, and you'll be like, if you're going to get him, this is the year to do it.
Right.
But he's not going uphill from here.
Right.
And then he never turns up.
Right, right. Well, even to the point where what I meant by that was, where my statement was, if I have a deer on trail camera, because trail cameras, just they just give me something to go look at more than anything. You can tell a lot, but you can't tell everything. So what I'll do is I'll use the trail cameras to find a deer of interest. You know, say he's a 150 type.
A DOI.
Yeah, yeah. And so I'll find a 150 class, whatever, something or other that I don't know. I'll go sit on that deer with my big lens to find an identifier, you know, to find a split ear. Because you can't always notice those little spot on the ear, different characteristic on the body. You can't always notice those in trail cams the first time you see one. So you have to see them in person. And then I'll get a picture of them broadside, print it out in an 8x10, put it in a folder. And then next year, do the same thing. Then I can put those pictures right next to each other and see who's who. But usually when we do green light a buck, a trophy buck to shoot, we shot one 2 years ago that was, I think it took him 30 or 35 sits before he killed him.
We had because one, what was happening?
It's nocturnal. It is nocturnal and will not show up in the daylight, even with all the feed in the world that you want to put out. They get, we do a lot of selective harvest for population control. And what we're trying to do is we reduce the stress by reducing the population and creating more feed. But that in
turn, you know, that's one of the things I want to ask you about. Let me back up a minute. Okay. I want to ask you about another thing. You guys are like a couple of bad dates. You have any, like nothing.
It's all coming out.
Nothing. Your little brain, nothing is going like, oh, I wish I knew a little more about that.
It's all coming out.
You're asking the good questions, man.
Really? So, like, you'll have something on the tip of your tongue, and then I'll say it.
Yep.
Yep. Well, or you just keep talking, and then I'll think about something else, and then it just keeps going. Makes you bored. It keeps drifting away.
All right. I'm starting to think that something's wrong with you guys.
No, man. I'm just fascinated. Learning about whitetail.
Okay. I'm going to jump you around a little bit. Now, I can't remember. I interrupted you before you got into something I wanted to ask you about. What were you just going to get into?
I don't know. I'm not the one paying attention.
About bringing the population down.
Oh, yeah. About the importance of not having too many deer.
Right.
But as a kid, and Yanni can back me up on this, as a kid growing up in whitetail country in Michigan, and I was like our big game animal, our only big game animal is whitetails, it was like you age deer, at least in your head. You age deer by what their antlers look like. So everyone knew that a spike or fork was a year and a half old. If he was a Michigan 6 or a Michigan 8 or Western 3, let's just make a deal. You guys use Eastern count?
Yeah.
Five on one side, five on the other side, he's a 10-point?
Right.
Count the brow tines?
Right.
Okay. We start calling them Michigan 6s because everybody in the damn country has a different way of counting them. We're only speaking Eastern. So a 6 or an 8 was 2.
Yeah.
Right? And that was like just accepted wisdom. The other piece of accepted wisdom was a spike wasn't going to become big because he's already small.
Yeah.
Now, speak to that stuff. Like what can you actually tell with age by looking at the antlers on a deer?
That's a tough one. Cause I mean, I've seen antlers are, I guess in a way they're an indication of age. If you look at mass but as far as number of points and spread, none of that seems to matter on age.
Cause you were just showing me an 8-point that was a year and a half old.
Yeah. Yeah. We had an 11-point this year that was a year and a half old. I had a 6-pointer with a drop tine. It was a year and a half old this year.
So his first rack.
First rack, he had a drop tine. Yep. And then we have, you know, 7 and 8-year-old deer that have 8 points barely.
Do you ever get a deer older than one who's a forky?
Yeah. Yeah. I shot one a few years ago that was, he was a 2x2, 4-point, And he was, I think he was 5.5 by his tooth wear, which he could have been older.
So he just never, it just, all right.
Yeah,
he was a heavy 2-point.
Oh, he was a big 2-point.
Oh, he was? Yeah. Oh, so you looked at him and knew he wasn't.
Oh, yeah, he was probably 18 inches wide inside with like 8 or 9 inch G2s, but that's all he had.
Yeah.
He had nothing else. He was just two big forks. Like, it looked like a mule deer.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to do something else. I'm going to distract you in another way. Just throw this out. I just want to throw this out. Tell me the number of wild pigs that you have handled in by trapping and whatnot. How many wild pigs have you handled here in South Texas?
4,795 as of this morning.
4,795 wild pigs have passed through your hands.
Since I started counting.
And tell me, how old were you when you welded up your first pig trap?
14.
All right. So, deer.
That's just a little teaser for later.
That's a little teaser. So, deer now. You're saying, and you told me about this too, that too many, like, if you have too many deer running around, they're not going to get as big.
Okay.
Get into that a little bit.
Okay. It all boils down to population dynamics as far as, you know, Mother Nature's way is grow, 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 and then have a big die off and then grow, grow, grow. And once it surpasses carrying capacity, once the land surpasses the carrying capacity, it has a die off. And so basically you have these big spikes on the graph up and down, up and
down.
Don't
some species just hit carrying capacity and then level off?
I'm sure they do. The ones that I'm studying don't, or that I'm dealing with, quail and deer, for instance. they hit carrying capacity and they keep reproducing. And then all of a sudden there's, you know, too many, less and less food, more competition, and they start getting the first
the
thing,
species people look at when they're kind of talking about that that phenomenon is people like to look at snowshoe hares.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
where exactly. It's so cyclical that it falls in the line, what is it, 7 years?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like dialed in.
Right.
And then you look at, they did this study where they looked at snowshoe hare patterns, and they went back through all the Hudson Bay Company records on lynx. How many hides, lynx hides, were getting handled. And it was offset, but lynx, who their primary prey species is snowshoe rabbits, they looked at Hudson Bay Company lynx hide receipts and realized that lynx seemed to bounce along in a 7-year span, offset from the snowshoe hare 7-year span.
Right. Yeah.
Like just responding to that.
A direct response. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. Well, and see, whitetails do it. It's more gradual. And now that people, there's such a high profile animal and game animal that people are never going to let them die off, but they will let them overpopulate. And the first thing that they, but they won't ever let them reach that point where they start dying off. But what happens is people get greedy and they want to let as many survive as possible.
Thinking that even big buck guys.
Even the big
buck. As many as possible thinking that someone's going to turn up who's real big.
Right.
With all these damn deer.
They think that giant deer are an anomaly and they're not. They're a low percentage. They're not. There's a certain percentage of whitetails that are going to be big, and it's just a straight up bell curve. And the middle range down here is about 130 inches. And what we do, or what I do to lower the population, we cull animals to lower the population to reduce stress. And whitetails, in my opinion, are completely stress oriented. Rather, it's food, water, bedding cover. Everything is stress related. So if you have too many, it may not look like the habitat is suffering, but they're competing directly with food. And same thing with bedding cover. And so the first thing to go on a whitetail is when it's trying to survive is antler growth.
It's a luxury.
It's pure luxury. And we do feed here. So certain people in Texas feed to offset. They think they can offset that stress level of competition in natural habitat. We feed as a supplement to help them out through drought conditions. So you don't have those spikes in the graph like we were talking about. We try to level it out as much as we can to, because that reduces the stress. The spike up or the spike down are all creating stress on individual animals.
Yeah. So culling is the practice of going out and killing deer.
Yeah.
Both to reduce numbers and to make some kind of selection about who's going to be on the property and who's not, right?
Correct.
And just to explain this, because Texas runs wildlife so differently than so many places in the U.S. The state will come out to a big chunk of ground in Texas and make an assessment about how many deer you guys are supposed to kill. Because the state's trying to encourage you to not let them get overrun.
The state is 100% worried about habitat. They want the habitat to be healthy. They don't care about, or they do. They do care about the animals, but they realize that if you have great habitat, you're going to have healthy animals.
Okay.
And that's their number one focus.
So their number one focus is that you're not going to allow your habitat to become degraded, to have long-term degradation in the name of short-term bunch of deer running around.
Right.
Or cattle,
yeah. But those are on private land. See, this it's mostly private land, and that's all the state. Those are recommendations by the state. The state's not forcing you.
Yeah.
You know, but the people that want to be good land stewards and want to grow better deer and have better long-term wildlife programs and cattle grazing programs request the state's assistance to come out and tell them what they should or shouldn't do.
And they'll come out and say, like, just using, it doesn't have to be specific to this place, but they'll come out to a property like this. And they'll come out and say, you boys would be wise to kill 400 deer this year. Here are your tags. Here are your certificates for those 400 deer.
Yeah. Yeah. And they base that on several different, they do browse surveys. So they look at whatever the deer are eating. And if the plants look stressed out, then they'll give you more tags or less tags versus based off of what they notice on the plants. They do surveys, population surveys to see what that particular piece of ground is capable of handling.
And the best way to count deer here is helicopter, right?
Helicopter here. You can use spotlights too, but it's too thick here. So we use predominantly, what I do is I try to use a helicopter survey in tandem with the cameras. And I try to get an individual buck count on the cameras and then get your buck doe ratio from the helicopter and your fawn survival from your helicopter.
Yeah.
So you take your individual buck count from the camera and apply that to the buck doe ratio, and then you get your number of does, and then you apply your fawn crop to that and get your total number of deer.
And when they come out and give you, is 300 like a decent number for a big chunk of land? 300, 400?
Probably.
Are you raising your hand?
I am.
Holy cow, Yanni. Giannis woke up. Giannis woke up and has a thought.
I have a question too after Yanni.
Yep. Thank God.
See, I want to interrupt, man, with like a dumb question. You guys got such good questions. I don't want to be like, hey, what does this mean?
You know what? Chris is being so polite right now. I'll tell you what the deal is. There's so much talking that goes on that it's hard to even slip in a question sometimes.
No, it's not. I'll break in right now. Okay, you start talking. Say something.
Yanni,
hey. So here's what I'm wondering. It's just like as simple as that.
Tell me about when you do a helicopter survey, kind of just like give me the breakdown of how that happens, like the main steps. Like skip the, you know, before I got in, I took a pee. But once you get in there, you take off, deer start flushing. And what are you actually looking for and what are you recording and writing down?
Well, the way I do it, sir, everybody does it different. But the way I do it is you separate the property into like a grid or transects, line transects. And those could be, depending on visibility, if the vegetation is high or the vegetation is low, that decides what your transects are going to be. You know, whether they're going to be 100 yards apart where you're running down, you know, running down, turning around, coming back, running down, turning back, or if they're going to be 400 yards apart. And based off of the density of the brush or the density of vegetation and what you can see, that's how you estimate how much of the property you can cover with the helicopter, how much you're surveying. Say it's 80%.
In this sort of thick-ass country, what is a transect?
It's usually about 200 yards. Because you can see at 200 yards, you can usually see 100 yards out both sides. So you'll move over.
And how many feet high are you flying?
It varies depending on the vegetation, but it's not, I guess it'd be probably 50 or 50.
Oh, you're just skimming. It's nothing like an airplane.
No, the skids are touching the tops of the trees sometimes. It's pretty low. And depending on the wind too, if it's real windy, we'll get higher just so we don't crash. But so what we'll do is we'll fly these transects, and I guess they'd be 400 yard transects if you can see 100 yards either way, is what it would boil down to. So what you're looking for is when a deer flushes, you usually can't see them if they stand still. But so you usually want to get them to flush. So you don't want to fly on a windy day or a hot day where they're going to be bedded or not hear you. You want to fly on a calm, cool day, usually cloudy work, so that way they're moving as soon as they hear you. And what we'll do is we'll count bucks, does, and fawns is pretty much what you're counting. And you can tell the difference between the does and the fawns pretty well. We usually fly in October, so the fawns are pretty small. And then the bucks break into subcategories, and I break them into young bucks, middle-aged bucks, and old bucks. And then, and like I said, that gives you your sex ratio and your ratio of young versus middle age versus old bucks. And then it also gives you your fawn survival for that summer. And you take those ratios and apply them to your individual buck count from your cameras. And
I'm tracking, kind of.
And through all that, the state will take those numbers and say...
And they accept your numbers.
They accept mine. They don't accept everybody. Sometimes they have to have a state employee in the helicopter with you.
Okay. But if you're trained in it, you can get to a point where they'll accept your numbers.
Yeah, if you're trained in it and they trust you and they know you're not going to screw up, then they'll take your numbers. And I've been doing it for 10 or 12 or almost 14 years, I guess, now. But
what's your level of accuracy? Like, do you plus and minus, like...
No, you're not... Well, see, with the helicopter ratios, you're not trying to get a number. You're just trying to get the ratio.
Oh, right, okay.
So with the individual buck counts, so say you have, one-to-one ratio, and you see 300 bucks on the trail camera, so you have 300 does on a one-to-one ratio. So you have 600 deer, but then you have a 50% fawn survival, and what 50% fawn survival means, you have 300 does, you have 150 fawns. That's 50%. So in that situation, you have 750 total deer on the property. And you can't really, a lot of people do the helicopter survey, and that's how many deer they think they have. But what you just mentioned, your level of accuracy changes from property to property, depending on who's flying, depending on weather. There's too many variables to...
Yeah, but it gives you a good idea and better than nothing.
Exactly. Exactly.
What was your other question? Because that question was prompted by something that was spoken after you expressed interest in asking a question.
No, that was it. That
no.
Was it. No, it was. Yeah, yeah.
Honestly?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
all right. You all up to speed? Okay. Now, they give you these tags. There's a penalty if you go over. There's no penalty for going under.
They frown upon going under.
They do.
Yeah.
So when they come out and say, son, we're thinking that you need to do some deer shooting out here, they're not happy if you just don't do any deer shooting.
No, I mean, if you go through the process of getting the permits, and it's a long process.
Oh,
see, you can, there's
so you could just as well never bring any of this up and never get any permits and
do whatever you wanted to what your license allows, which is
your over the counter when you buy a deer tag.
Right. And the way people get around that is they just bring in more guests, more guests to shoot deer. So then they can overshoot deer that way.
So this is a thing you kind of, a thing you enroll in in a plan you enroll in.
Yeah. It's a long-term several year system just to get started in the program.
And when they give you the tags, it doesn't matter who's pulling the trigger.
Okay. There's three levels of these permits. And I believe the first level, I don't remember. I haven't been in the first and second level in 10 years. So I don't remember, but, and Scott would know if we get him on here later, but, the level three, anybody can shoot as many deer. So if you get 100 tags, one person could shoot 100 deer legally, and they could use all the tags, or you could have 100 different people shoot one deer. It makes no difference. And on the highest level.
So someone hunting on that property needs to have a hunting license.
They have to have a hunting license, yes.
And there's a stack of tags.
Yeah.
And when a deer is killed on that property, one of those tags goes on to that deer.
One of the state-issued permits goes on that deer. One of your license, your tag off of your over-the-counter license does not go on that deer if your property is enrolled in that permit system.
So when you go buy a tag and it comes with five deer tags, but you're only hunting on your property and you have state-issued tags on your property, you never touch your tags.
Correct. I have not used a whitetail tag off of my license in 6 or 7 years.
Because you're just doing...
I'm only hunting here. Or on properties that that have the same permitting system.
Same permitting system. Okay. Now, earlier you were talking about that a buck... You're telling me that when a doe has twin fawns, 80% of the time, those twin fawns have different fathers.
The last study that I read was in this Southwest Texas.
This information is somewhat specific to this area.
Yeah, it's everything site specific with whitetails. They change so much from area to area, because we have such tight sex ratios, 1-to-1 most of the time, or even higher bucks than does.
Yeah, and I'll point out that they're born 1-to-1.
Yeah, right, right. A little heavier on the bucks.
Yeah. So when you're sitting, like when I was growing up, you'd be sitting in there in the woods, and you'd see about 90 does for every buck you saw.
Right, or in Michigan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that was, like, I moved away from Michigan, but I was born, you know, I'm 42 years old, so I started hunting when I was, you know, 11, 12 years old. And back then, people didn't want to shoot does. Everybody shot every buck they saw, right? And you'd sit up there and be like, I remember sitting there one time in a cornfield, and I remember it was like a late season hunt, so rifle season ended. I was hunting the December season with my bow, and I remember counting 90-some white-tailed does without a buck.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was a good indication of the sex ratio, or was it a indication of hunting pressure for the bucks?
I don't know. But my feeling was, growing up, and it was a long time ago, and I wasn't taking a scientific approach to it. My feeling was, back then in those days, that the ratios were as ridiculous. They got to be as ridiculous as, like, you'd hear thrown around, you'd have 20 does for every buck.
Yeah, there's places in Texas like that, that are neglected or not managed, and only shoot the bucks. Same deal like you're talking about that happened right now, today.
But yeah, so it's interesting in that they're born 1-to-1, but of course, one thing that skews it is, I'm sure the doe's got to have a much longer life expectancy.
Yeah.
Is that true?
In unmanaged places, I would believe so, yes. In managed places, I don't think so.
But, is that right?
Yeah.
So let's just say all people died right now, okay? Humans ceased to exist. And we jump into the future 100 years. Based on your understanding of whitetails, would whitetails exist then at a 1-to-1 ratio?
And it just, I guess it depends on their location, but I would believe yes.
You believe they'd find a way toward that?
Mm-hmm. I believe, especially in this area, they gravitate to 1-to-1.
Okay. So, the twin fawn thing. That a doe is getting bred by a bunch of different bucks.
Yeah. I watched a doe with a rut train one time. It had 7 bucks. 7 bucks with 1 doe that was hot. And she was in a field. And I watched 6 of those bucks breed her. A couple of them multiple times.
Weren't you telling me all but the big one?
The only one that never bred her was the big one.
While you watched?
Yeah. While I was
because he was so paranoid about trying to beat all the other ones off.
He chased one 100 yards the other way, and another one would run in and breed her, mount her, breed her, and then he'd turn around and see that one breeding her, turn around and chase him off, and then another one would come in from the other side. There was a couple of those bucks that bred her multiple times, and he never bred her.
What's the time frame that's even, like, biologically possible to be bred by 2 different bucks? Is it, like, same day, or?
Yeah, I think their estrus is 24 to 48 or something like that.
So she forms 2 embryos, and just because she's in there being so trashy, that winds up carrying in her the children of 2 different bucks.
Right. It works with dogs. If you breed three male dogs to the same female, they can have, you know, puppies from all 3 sires.
Mixed litters.
Yeah.
Is it, like, here's another thing we used to say when we were kids. That a buck bred a big buck, once he got to be the big man, like the biggest buck around, he'd breed 10 to 20 does.
That's possible. It doesn't happen. On what I notice here with a 1-to-1 ratio, I think every buck is pretty well equal from my observations. Yearling bucks in this area of Texas, this is a small, minute little spot, but in my observations, yearling bucks breed as much as older bucks. All age classes are pretty well consistent.
Huh.
Depending on the individual. You get, it's just like people. You get the real horny ones, and you get the ones that are just laid back, and all they do is want to eat.
Yeah.
It's the same deal with deer. And I mean, some bucks may not breed any does their whole life, or one or two, just that just happen to stop and squat in front of them.
What's that Valerius Geist theory? I think we were talking to you
about the founder effect.
Huh?
I was going to bring up the founder effect earlier.
Is that the one where the buck takes himself out of the breeding process?
Oh, was that Val Geist?
I think so.
I never really believed that theory.
Yeah.
Is that something he put forward?
I got to Google it.
Do it, because I'll tell you another Val Geist thing. I think it was Valerius Geist who... There's a very famous mammalogist in Calgary at the university there. He's still living. I've never met him. Named Valerius Geist. And he has, he's like a big ideas guy about animals. And he wrote about, and they might even have come up, coined the term the founder effect, basically about the, when animals come into a new area, when they discover new range, or having a range expansion from something like retreating glaciers at the end of the ice age, or whatever, the tendency toward gigantism that happens with animals moving into a new piece of habitat. And we see it with introductions, wildlife introductions, explosions, right? Giant specimens, a whole bunch of them. And then you have like a collapse, and then you kind of find a norm. But that was a Val Geist thing. Yeah, he's going to dig it up. Yeah, I heard this theory like that bucks, it just, yeah, I don't even need to look the damn thing up. It was this idea that I think you were talking about, Giannis, that a buck will be like, hey, man, I got an idea. I'm going to pull myself out of the genetic pool and go off and hide out for several years and get real big and bad. And then I'm going to come down and pour the coals to every doe I can find. I'm going to come out of like hiding like I'm in a Hollywood movie and pour the coals to every doe that I could find.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you'd ever seen that. If you'd seen bucks that for like 4 or 5 years had been just real mellow, weren't very aggressive, and because of that, you know, had put on weight and gotten big, and then all of a sudden one year they just turned it on and kind of started kicking butt.
It's like a version of the old like, hey, let's run down and breed one of those cows. And the old one's like, let's walk down and breed them all. It's kind of like an extreme version of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't noticed that here. it seems...
You haven't noticed a big buck hiding somewhere for many years and then all of a sudden coming out and just pillaging the women.
I'll say what I've noticed is when they're horny at one, they're horny their whole life.
Mm.
When all they want to do is eat and they don't really look at the girls, they're like that their whole life. You know, as far as
fight, that's like folks
fighting and breaking tines, there's bucks that never break even a tip for 8 or 9 years of their life. Then there's other bucks that are have every tine on their head broken by November.
He's just going to fight.
He's just, that's...
I knew guys like that.
Yeah, exactly. They're just like people, and they're so individual that that's what makes it fun, and that's what makes it hard, and that's what also makes it so interesting to me, because nobody's ever right and nobody's ever wrong.
Yeah.
Your theories and everything that you do, you know, it has an application somewhere.
So you're not shooting all the giant bucks.
No.
You don't shoot the 200 inch bucks.
No.
And I know you get paid to do it. You could probably get paid to do all kinds of stuff. What do you get out of it?
It's a passion. It's just something that I've developed over the years, and now it's more of an addiction. It started out as a passion, and now it's more of an addiction. I couldn't turn my back to it now if I wanted to. And
we talked about this word earlier, watching like a system.
Yeah. Just
a wildlife system.
Right. Just learning as much as I possibly can about, you know, that animal.
How much do you feel that you're manipulating it to the point where you're farming deer? And how much do you feel you're just making room for things? You're making room to allow things that would happen.
I feel very strongly that, as far as I feel like we're trying to let things occur that would naturally occur, and maybe putting them on a fast track with an indirect approach.
Meaning in real, like again, in this scenario, this hypothetical scenario where all humans die, you would, all humans are dead. You would see that some deer were growing to 9 years old and dying of old age.
Yeah.
Which is not happening in Muskegon County, Michigan, where I grew up, even kind of.
Is there hunting? Yeah. So if there wasn't people. Yeah.
No, there is no old buck.
Right.
We about shit our pants one year my dad shot a buck that, looking back, must have been a 2.5-year-old buck. It was a giant.
Yeah, yeah.
He even got it in the newspaper. It was a 120-inch buck.
Yeah. No, man, I don't know. That they all revert back. It goes back to those spikes in the populations. What I'm trying to do is avoid the spikes. If people disappeared in 100 years from now, it would be the up and down population.
Wildly cyclical.
Yes. And there would be years or points in that process or that system of ups and downs that would be mirror to what we're trying to do here. But it wouldn't be consistent. You know what I
mean? Yeah, you know, no, I'm saying.
You know, it'd be up and down. But while it was going up, it would be what we're trying to hit here. And that's all we're trying to do, is we're just trying to slow that down.
Yep. How will you, like, right now, if you had to sit right now and say, in my career, I would measure success by what? What would it be? Not only say your career, because you're young. Like, in what would be the ideal thing that you would see happen on a property you were managing? Like, what would be a 10-year goal?
Well, like a 10-year, I don't know. I don't know if I could fathom what I really want to happen.
But you don't know what it would look like.
No, I don't have any idea what it would look
like. Because see, the situation you're in, I remember earlier you were mentioning that, and you weren't putting this as a life goal, but you were just saying like a thing that would happen perhaps is that every year you'd get it to be where you had a handful, 2, 3, 4, truly like outstanding whitetails
right
come off your property. But one would point out you could do that right now,
right,
by going online and buying, like, you know, big thunderfox semen.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Right.
And putting them in a pen and giving them a bunch of stuff, right? So it's like you want to get there, but you want to get there in a route that is acceptable to you, or a route that's correct, interesting to you, and not through a route that's not interesting to you.
Correct.
Be like, I want to have $1 million. I can make it crooked. I'm not saying me, but right. So it could be like, I want $1 million. I want to make it through running like a great company that treats its employees really well and has like stable growth patterns and a good environmental record. Or I want to make $1 million. I don't care. I have to kill you to do it.
Right. That's exactly. I mean, exactly right. My problem is as far as seeing into the future, my goals would be, yeah, to have a couple of gigantic whitetail bucks at a harvestable age each year. However, nobody's doing what we're trying to do here, or has done what we're trying to do here to the intensity that we're doing it. So you can't really predict what's going to happen.
Yeah. It's not like if you follow this recipe, X will.
Right. Nobody, yeah. And it's so different, you know, from site to site, and that's why that question is difficult for me to answer.
Yeah.
Because I don't really know. Something might happen that we don't see, because this is never, you know, nobody's done this. It's not like, you know, like you said, you follow a recipe and this is what you're going to end up with. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Mother Nature has a awesome way of saying screw you, you know, and throwing a wrench into things when you try to start messing with her.
Yeah.
And that's another fun part for me.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier like an unintended consequences when we were talking about quail, and you were saying you can think you're helping out quail,
yeah,
by putting out quail feeders, but what you might be doing is helping out bobcats and coyotes by giving them a great place to kill quail.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Like intuitively be like, oh yeah, put some food out, dude. You have tons of quail.
Yeah. That's how there's a lot of things that got screwed up in the US that are started out as good intentions. And the byproducts were, you know, completely disastrous.
Yanni?
Speaking of unintended consequences, you know, that's what's cool about this place is that it's all, you guys are trying to do all like native flora. And like, while we, you know, you come down here and you've got the whole high fence thing in your head and you're thinking about exotics and there's going to be zebras running around and this, that, and the
dude,
other.
Yeah.
And like, let's like list off the cool stuff that we've seen this week. The
4 species of snakes.
Yeah. A horny toad.
Texas tortoise.
Texas tortoise.
A grinner.
Grinner.
Which about 300 jackrabbits.
Yeah. 500 cottontail rabbits.
Cottontail.
Unbelievable Mexican black-bellied whistling ducks. Unbelievable varieties of birds.
Yeah.
I haven't seen this one kudu roll through yet.
Yeah.
That's kind of why I want to have this discussion is because my like the first time I ever came down here to like the famous Texas whitetail country was when I came down with Ben O'Brien to come down here and just look at quail. And I remember walking around being like, this is just not what I imagined. You know, it is it is vast expanses of, I don't want to say pristine. The hand of man has felt, like we, for instance, talked about the implications of fire suppression.
Right.
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 You and I were having, Ben in here, we were discussing like, wow, what would you have paid to rode a horse through here 200 years ago? And he feels that it would have been more mixed grasslands.
Yeah.
From making mosaics of burned areas and unburned areas. And the animal, the wildlife is a little different. Buffalo or bison ranged down in this area, which suggests more open country. Antelope were found down here, which suggests more open country. So there's the hand of man is felt.
Right.
You know, through that same way, interrupting systems, fire systems and things. However, vast expanses of what by a relative standard of what goes on in the U.S. would be undisturbed environment. Privately owned, but vast expanses of undisturbed landscape. Wildlife habitat.
Yeah.
And a pretty stunning array of native wildlife. You know?
Yeah.
It's some tremendous wildlife viewing.
Yeah.
Here. And unusual things. We saw a snake I had never heard of. The blue, what's it called?
Blue indigo.
The blue indigo.
Yeah.
Saw a souped up friggin' rattlesnake. Oh, it's been interesting.